started.
Coming up on one of the big theorems of linear algebra.
The spectral theorem.
Did anybody want to ask me any questions about any earlier stuff? Stuff you read? Stuff you tried? Homework problems or anything like that? Yes?
Can I just ask about the makeup very quick?
Sure.
Is it also going to be from 1A to 3D, or are you going to extend it or add more to it?
No, I'm not going to extend it.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
I would be happy if you could just solve three of the six questions I put on that on the first exam. So I don't need to change the exam. So think of it as a revision, like a homework revision, right? So I put some comments on it. See if you can come up with some corrections and get it. Maybe you can get it perfect. There won't be revisions for the final exam, but maybe with this midterm exam we can get all A's. Or other questions? All right, so there are some things that have been theorems earlier in the book, last few sections. I was like, oh, that's nice, I guess, but it's not clear what they were for. Some of them are for proving nicer stuff, like the spectral theorem. There's two versions of it. The first version, the easier version to prove, is when you have a complex finite dimensional inner product space. And you have a linear operator, so it sends this space V back to itself. The question is, when can we diagonalize it? That's usually what you're interested in. Now, in general, the answer to that is complicated. But you can make the answer short and sweet if you ask for more than just diagonalizing with respect to some basis. We ask for something really strong here. We ask, can we find an orthonormal basis, one that has geometric significance? Right. Kind of like you have the x, y, and z axes all at right angles to each other. You give them some scales and so on. Right? Can we have an orthonormal basis that diagonalizes the matrix? So by making the problem harder, and hence making the solution set, the set of diagonalizable operators, smaller by placing this extra restriction on the basis, orthonormal. I guess the normal part isn't so important for this question, but it is important for the proofs. So it's a very short and sweet answer.
If and only if T is normal.
On the face of it, T is normal seems to have nothing to do with diagonalizability. But
actually it does, right? So remember, this just means that T commutes with its adjoint, right? Which in matrix terms is the complex conjugate of the transpose matrix. At least that's what it is in matrix terms if you're using an orthonormal basis. So over the complex field, we can say exactly when you can diagonalize for a nice basis. The book says slightly more. I mean, if you're looking at this, right, it's, 724. It's not just that you when you diagonalize, you automatically get a basis of eigenvectors. And the book doesn't even bother to prove that part. Because it's, as the book says, it's something easy if you're comfortable with the eigenvector stuff when it was covered. But when your matrix is diagonal, that means your basis vectors have to be eigenvectors. Because a diagonal matrix just multiplies each basis element by a constant when it transforms it, right? It's just a bunch of scale changes that operate independently of each other. There's no rotation, no shear, no reflection. Well, okay, negative eigenvalue would be a reflection. Yeah. So this is the same as V having an orthonormal basis. Of eigenvectors of T. So that's supposed to be obvious.
If it's not obvious, then you're supposed to go back to chapter 5, right?
See why that's equivalent and why Axler doesn't think it's worth proving that equivalence here. And okay, so this is 724. So what are the two main ingredients of the proof of 724? Main or two active ingredients, right? Stuff that's really doing all the work. Right? One is I'm not sure how to say this guy's name, Schur's theorem, I guess. Right? Schur's theorem tells you that, without any assumptions on T, right? Back in chapter 6, right? It just says, you've got an upper triangular matrix for some orthonormal basis. So that's 6B, if I remember. Yes, 6B. 638. Okay. So, just because it's a complex finite dimensional inner product space, any linear operator has at least an upper triangular matrix. So you're halfway to diagonal. Right? For some orthonormal basis. The hard part is getting the angles to be right angles. The orthonormal part after that is easy. Just rescale all the vectors to have norm 1.
So that relies on the fact that just because we're using the complex numbers, the polynomials have roots, you can always get eigenvectors. And I talked a little bit about this. The point was that the Gram-Schmidt process could take a basis that made things upper triangular, which you get using a Chapter 5 proof by looking at eigenvectors first of T and then of either restrictions or quotients of T. You get the rest in an iterative process. Right, you get a basis that makes it upper triangular, and then the Gram-Schmidt process will improve that basis to an orthonormal basis without breaking up the upper triangular property. So that's some Chapter 5 stuff and some Chapter 6 stuff. So even this theorem, you know, itself is building on earlier stuff. That's what mathematicians consider a deep result, is when there's a whole, you know, tower of things, right, that you use to finally prove your theorem. So if you start at the top and look at the theorem, then you keep digging down and down, you keep saying, oh, it builds on this, it builds on that, but it needed that, right? It's shallow if all I need to do is write down the definitions, and then here's, you know, a paragraph or whatever that gives me the theorem, right? That's shallow, right? The idea is, oh, anybody could have done that. They just thought about the definitions for a few hours, right? Well, maybe, maybe not. Some shallow proofs took a long time to find. But anyways, yeah. A lot of mathematicians really like the deep proofs. So they've got this big, you know, edifice of theory to lead up to something. So yeah, you have eigenvectors, you have Gram-Schmidt, put them together, you get Schur's theorem. Then Schur's theorem gives you the complex spectral theorem. The other ingredient, at least in Axler's proof, is that this property holds. Which seems like a funny looking property. The proof is not that hard. It's pretty clever. I wouldn't have guessed it the first time I saw the proof. I was like, what? How'd you come for that? And it never would have occurred to me to even try to prove this. But in any case, it's true, and it allows Axler to combine the results of Schur's theorem with this equation to show that actually, when you get the upper triangular matrix from some orthonormal basis, you're done, because it turns out that when it's a normal operator, that normality via this equation here actually forces any basis that gives you upper triangular to actually also be a very special kind of upper triangular, where all the stuff above the diagonal is zero, not just the stuff below. So yeah, these are the two working ingredients in the proof. So it's this cute little argument that there's a bunch of, you know, sum of squares stuff, right, like Pythagorean theorem. And you show that, you know, on the left side you've got one square, on the right side you've got a bunch of squares. You show that on the right side, okay, one of those squares has to match the left side. So all the other squares, there's no room for them to be anything but zero. And that's how you zero out everything above the diagonal. Very nice. Some, you know, maybe weird-looking things like this. You know, their purpose is really for proving some nice theorem later. Otherwise, I'm sure Axler would have, you know, left out a result like this or left it as an exercise, because on its own, it's frankly not that interesting. It's just a little curiosity.
but as a part of some deep theory, you know, I'm getting a very nice result like this.
Yeah, then it becomes important. And people really care about when we can diagonalize and when not. If you have done some differential equations, you know how nice it is to have the eigenvectors, eigenvalues, have the nice diagonal matrix, you know, the exponential of the diagonal matrix, very important, say, and very easy. Exponential of the non-diagonal matrix, very hard. Generally, the only way you get it is by diagonalizing or taking the next best thing, the Jordan normal form, which we'll get to in a later section. All right. And that's the complex one. Questions or comments about this? So, if you want to actually make this computational, you would have to actually dig into how do you get that upper triangular basis, or upper triangular making basis. I'm cursed there. Well, first you got a basis that made upper triangular, then you did Gram-Schmidt. Okay, you know how Gram-Schmidt works. Then you'd have to look into the proof that you can get an upper triangular basis at all, and that involves that iterative thing with the eigenvectors. And Dr. Lin could tell you a lot more about how to actually find eigenvectors computationally. There's a lot of different ways to do it, and they have different advantages and disadvantages. Let's see here. Now, there's a cute little exercise at the end, right? Number 15. Apparently this guy reads web comics. So there's three matrices that presumably with respect to, you know, some orthonormal basis, right, they're supposed to be normal operators, right? Matrices of normal operators on the left. There's the non-normal one on the right. Now the problem Axler gives us is, okay, one of those normal operators, it's got one of the entries of its matrix covered up. So he wants us to figure out what that entry has to be in order to be normal. So that's a fun problem. If we don't do anything else tonight, let's see if we can figure out that one. Okay. See how hard this is. Okay. So the dimension of V is 3, and I think we should make the underlying field complex. We could choose, right, because all the entries we see are real, so it could be either way, but for real fields, real vector spaces, the characterization of normality is not so simple. What you instead get for the real spectral theorem is a characterization of the self-adjoint matrices. So since we could choose, let's use complex here. So then we'll have the complex spectral theorem to help us. Right. Okay, so we have this linear operator, and there's some basis that makes
Axler actually likes to use the parentheses, not the square brackets. And T is normal. Maybe assume a few more things. I think, we could assume, say, that this is for the standard 3D complex inner product space. We could assume that that basis giving that matrix is the standard one, which is an orthonormal basis. What's the standard basis? For lists of three things, right? We start with 100. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes it pretty concrete then. Okay. Still have to fill in the question mark. All right. So what was our theorem here? There's an orthonormal basis that diagonalizes it, which is the same as saying that we have an orthonormal basis of eigenvectors. So that'd be one way to approach it. We try and figure out what are the eigenvectors. Another way to go at it would be to just directly look at matrices, multiply two matrices, and see what constraint is made by this equation here. So we have two ways to go. So what looks easier? Should we multiply some matrices, or should we dig into the eigenvectors? All right, let's try that. Okay. So if t star equals t star t, that'll be true with respect to any orthonormal basis. So we can just now the matrix of T star will be the conjugate transpose, right? Because this is an orthonormal basis, right? Because we know that, everything can be turned into a purely computational thing with matrix numbers in it, right? So, now, remember, if it's not an orthonormal basis, then conjugate transpose may not give you the correct matrix for the adjoint. But for our basis here, we're good to go. So, all right, I will call it Z. Okay? And take the transpose. Take the conjugate. Off the diagonal here. 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, Z bar, 0, 0, Z. And let's see here. To avoid having to also do this multiplication, right? Having to switch the orders. Is there any way I can avoid having to do the other multiplication? Or am I just stuck? I think of a matrix A. I've got this transpose. I'm trying to think if I could do a shortcut here. How does that compare to this thing? This thing is A times. If I took, say, the transpose of this, what would I have? I would have. Remember, with transposes, it swaps things around. It changes the order. This. That doesn't help, does it?
Dr. Village?
Yeah.
the 0 and the result there, shouldn't that be a 1?
Maybe. Let's see if I got it wrong.
Yeah, it should be a almost symmetric matrix, shouldn't it? This one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, second row. Yeah, that's a 1.
Okay, well, I'm not seeing a shortcut off the top of my head, so I will just do the other matrix multiplication. Okay. Let's work in the other order. Maybe one of you is faster than I am and has already done it. And
tried it. Did it come out any different?
Still 2, right?
And then this one is 1. So 1.
Z. Ooh, that looks interesting. Yeah. Okay. And, okay. Well, we'll keep going, but probably this tells us what we need, right? Z should be 1. Yeah? These two are supposed to be the same. Right? I guess we could check, but probably the rest is not that exact. 1, 0, 0, yeah. Match, okay. 1, 1, so much, and 0, so 2. Everything is matching. This is looking very promising. 0, 1, 1. Okay, so that's going to make Z bar be 1. Right. Okay, well, yeah, we can swing that. Yeah, sure. Z can be 1, then Z bar will also be 1. Let's go. What else is going on here? Make sure it's not a trick question, I guess. Okay, a Z bar. 0, 1, 0, 1. Okay, so these are going to have to match, but Z equals 1 will make them match. And then last one, 0, 1, plus Z bar Z. Okay, we're good. Everything's going to match. Z bar Z is the same as Z Z bar.
Okay, so the solution is that Z equals 1. Okay.
Anyways, that's a
cute little exercise choice. Although, to be honest, I don't see the deep theory in it. Normally, with the exercise he puts at the end, it's a hard exercise, you know? This one seems to just be fun.
I don't know.
I mean, we could have done something with the eigenvectors, but I think it would have been harder. You know, there wasn't a clever theoretical move to make here, at least not one I can see.
Okay.
All right. Now, since that wasn't so hard, take some pictures. Can look at some other problems of interest. Okay, so number boards here. This board.
I think the only questionable move here is this part where I said we could assume, you know, that we've got the standard basis. But
I think that's just an ambiguity in the problem. I mean, it gives you some matrices, but it doesn't say with respect to what basis. And it wouldn't really make sense to be talking about a matrix for an operator and whether or not it's normal if you're not using an orthonormal basis. And beyond that, the assumption that the matrix is with respect to an orthonormal basis, the rest doesn't matter in terms of, like, is it the standard 3D space and is it the standard orthonormal basis? Because the part here where we turned this operator equation into a matrix equation, the only thing we used was the fact that the basis was orthonormal. If it had been some other orthonormal basis, this would have worked out exactly the same way. If we had assumed that this was the matrix with respect to some other orthonormal basis, we would have gotten the same thing. So that's why I was feeling safe in assuming, say, it's the standard one. Because as long as it was some orthonormal basis, it all turns out the same. A lot of times if you read proofs in math papers, you'll see, we may assume this or we may assume that. And the author usually thinks, oh yeah, there's some easy argument for why you can make that assumption, but they didn't want to write it down. So watch out when people say we can assume this or that. There's something going on in their mind that they didn't want to write it down, probably. But if you don't see what's going on in their mind, then you need to figure it out or talk to the author and get them to explain it to you. Get some other person that understands the proof to explain it to you. There is something going on there. Looking at all these other exercises. This one looks interesting. So, in this whole chapter, remember that you're always assuming V is a finite dimensional inner product space. Right? And you're always assuming, well, let me see that. No, I think, yeah, that's just the standing assumption. And okay, so we have, and now T is a linear operator on V, so it maps V to V. The only thing that's ambiguous there is, like, what's the base field? Right? Let's assume it's the complex one. So and I'm looking at, say, number 8, right? Okay. Okay, so suppose that
if you apply this operator 9 times, then the result will always be the same as if you applied it 8 times, no matter what the input vector is. And also assume that applying T and then T adjoint is the same as applying T adjoint and then T. Prove that that means the operator is, the fancy word is idempotent, meaning if you apply the operator twice, it is the same as if you just applied it once, and hence you could apply it as many times as you wanted, and it would still be the same as just applying it once, right? Now, if you have it in this form, this definition of normal from 7a, and then this equation, you look at these two equations, you try and get to t squared equals t. Oh, no. You're gonna have lots of guesses for how the algebra might all work out together, but it's not going to be pretty. It's not going to go anywhere. Okay. This exercise doesn't come till 7b because this exercise is super hard without the spectral theorem. Right? Use the spectral theorem and this can become easy. Because t is normal, what can we say about a matrix for t? Remember why people are so excited about the spectral theorem is because it gives us a very nice, easy matrix in the right basis. Right? What will the matrix of T look like if we pick the right basis, which we know exists by that theorem? It'd
be diagonal, right? Okay. So. So for some orthonormal basis of V, MT is diagonal. So that means it's got a bunch of scalars. I'll write them as lambdas, not just because they're scalars, but because they are actually eigenvalues too. Okay? They're just some complex numbers, but okay, now what happens then? What is the matrix of the of applying T 9 times? Well, it's the 9th power of the matrix of T, which is just, because it's diagonal, super easy. It's just a bunch of 9th powers. When you have a diagonal matrix, one way to think about it is, okay, the eigenvectors don't interact with each other in some sense, right? You're just doing a scale change on each eigenvector without any mixing of them. So you apply that scale change 9 times, right? Each eigenvector gets scaled up 9 times. But on the other hand, we have the same thing for power 8. But these have to be the same, because we're assuming that applying the operator 8 times also gives you the same results as applying it 9 times. So the matrices will be the same.
Okay.
So Well, now it's easy algebra, right? Lambda I to the 9th equals lambda I to the 8th. If and only if 0 equals, you know, lambda I, right, the, for the ith eigenvalue in this list here. Right? So you factor out 8 factors of lambda I, and you get... lambda I minus 1. Right? So either lambda I to the 8th is 0, or lambda I equals 1. Okay. And I kind of ran out of room there, didn't I? Maybe if I started further left, but anyway, the point is you just do some basic algebra. If the 8th power is equal to the 9th power, the only complex numbers that satisfy that are 0 and 1. Which, in either case, the square will be the same as the original. 0 squared is 0, 1 squared is 1. So, the matrices for applying the operator twice and applying it once are the same. So, applying the operator twice is the same as applying it just once. This is a case where if you have the right tool, it's easy. It's not a big computation. And it's not even one of those big proofs where you had to start with some basis and extend to another basis and so on. Sometimes those are hard in their own way, even though it's not a big computation. But this one, if you have the right tool, it's a really short argument. I hope you'll forgive my kind of big zero notation. You know what I mean. It's diagonal entries are the lambdas, and everywhere off diagonal it's zero. Yeah. Okay. So we have the complex spectral theorem, and then there's the real spectral theorem, right? So if the underlying field is the reals and T maps are what is it, right? It's a finite dimensional inner product space to itself. So T turns vectors in V into vectors in V. Now we're in the real vector space, real inner product space, I should say, case. It's harder to characterize which operators are normal. But on the other hand, if you ask this question of, can I have
an orthonormal basis that diagonalizes the matrix, it turns out, again, there's a short and sweet answer. But the answer is different than in the complex case. So some orthonormal basis of V makes the matrix diagonal if and only if. And now, since it's harder to have eigenvectors because you don't have complex eigenvalues available anymore, it's harder to diagonalize the matrix, or to diagonalize the operator. It's harder to find a basis because, in some sense, you don't have half of what you had before. I mean, C3 is from our you know, physical perspective, we would kind of think of it as six-dimensional, right? Because there's three numbers, and each of them has a real part and imaginary part. So it seems like there's a lot of room there, right? And here now, you know, R3, it's really three-dimensional. And in general, you can have a matrix that has no real eigenvalues at all, right? So you don't have Schur's theorem here. Things are harder. So Axler has to do more work in this section to actually prove this, right? If you read how he proves it, there's some results, right? He proves that under additional assumptions, you can actually get a real eigenvalue, right? That is 7.27, right? In general, there may not be any real eigenvalues, but if you are self-adjoint, then there actually is an eigenvalue, even if your underlying field is the real field. So you actually get a real eigenvalue, and once you have a real eigenvalue, well, then you can use the eigenvectors to do what you need to do. And it's not quite the same proof even after that. There's more differences because you can use self-adjointness to kind of make a shortcut so you don't have to go through a real Schur's theorem and Gram-Schmidt all over again. Anyways, so what you end up with is so much, much harder than to have a diagonalizing basis with a real inner product space. Not only do you have to commute with your adjoint, you have to actually equal your adjoint. That's much stronger than normality.
This is 7.29, I think.
So if somebody says the spectral theorem, it's a little ambiguous whether or not they mean the real one or the complex one. At least historically, you know, people were most excited about this because, you know, now three dimensions really does mean three dimensions in the physical sense, right? So a matrix that's diagonal with respect to some orthonormal basis in R3, we really can picture that. We can imagine three arrows of length 1 all at right angles to each other as the basis. And so then this would be saying that the matrix really is just doing a scale change along each of those three perpendicular directions. So you can actually see it to some extent. Whereas, you know, with the complex one, you know, you can't quite see it the same way. So people were most excited about this. Now, today you have so many abstract papers out there.
You know, a lot of this stuff is studied also in quantum physics, where they're not interested in the real case at all. All they want is the complex stuff, because that's what makes the math easier in quantum physics. So you have to know your context, I guess, if you want to be sure which spectral theorem people are talking about. Anyways, so yeah, I have to do some more work to prove this one. A little more technical with some of the stuff, like there's the b squared minus 4c and all that. That's kind of a pain. It's a pain because you can't factor a real polynomial completely, right? You have these irreducible quadratic terms you can't factor into linear terms. All right. And one thing you might wonder about is, okay, I can believe that, yes, if it's a self-adjoint matrix, then everything is really nice. There's a lot of details, but I can believe that, yes, if it's self-adjoint, then I can cook up this nice basis. But why? Why does having the nice basis force me to be self-adjoint? In that direction of the proof, there should be an answer to that as well. And hopefully it's a little bit shorter of an answer. Right? So, one direction is going from diagonal at t equals t star, and the other direction is going from t equals t star to having that diagonalizing basis. Okay, so this direction, is the long direction, right? But this direction is actually pretty short. You can give a simple explanation for why, if you have a diagonalizing orthonormal basis, you actually have to be self-adjoint. This is not hard. So you can actually see why being merely normal is not enough. You can see that you really do have to be self-adjoint. I would not attempt to go through the whole proof of this in class, but we can see, without a big time investment, why we have to be self-adjoint. Let's see here. What? So this is the short part. If we can diagonalize with an orthonormal basis, then how do we know that T has to be T star?
Is that equal to its transpose?
Yes. And since we're in, yes, conjugate transpose, but since we're real, yeah. conjugate transpose is just transpose. That argument, of course, does not work, does it, in the complex case, right? Because these eigenvalues could have imaginary parts, right? So their complex conjugates could be different. So in the complex case, the diagonalizability does not force you to be self-adjoint. It just forces your eigenvalues to come in conjugate pairs, right? So maybe you have something like, I don't know, 1 plus 3i and 1 minus 3i. Here, I'll make it 3D. Here's an example. 1 plus 3i and 1 minus 3i. This is the kind of thing you could have. Take the conjugate transpose. So take the transpose, take the complex conjugate, do those two things in either order, and it's not the same, is it? They'll be normal, right? Because any two diagonal matrices commute. So T will commute with T star. Sometimes they come out blurry.
So we can see the distinction there. The diagonal matrices of T and T star will be complex conjugates of each other. So they'll commute by the fact that they're diagonal, but they can be different. In the real case, they're actually the same. The version I teach of the real spectral theorem in, say, undergraduate analysis is I would just tell them half of it. I would tell them if you have a real square, I wouldn't even tell them about the complex part probably, I'd just tell them, no. If you have a real square symmetric matrix, right, it is its own transpose, then we have a lovely basis of eigenvectors. We can diagonalize the matrix. That's what I tell them. And so yeah, I could tell them stuff like, well, here's a matrix, you know. Whatever, right? It's real, it's symmetric. Right? So you pick any orthonormal basis for this to be the representation, except I wouldn't even tell them about that, right? We would just, if I give them the matrix, it would be for the standard basis, 99% of the time in the undergraduate class, right? That's the kind of thing I would say, you know, at the undergraduate level. So maybe some of you will teach undergraduate linear algebra someday. And this is more the kind of thing you'll see in an undergraduate linear algebra textbook. They're probably not going to get into all this stuff about, you know, it's self-adjoint. They're probably not even going to say what adjoints are, right? If and only if, blah, blah, blah. They're just going to give the one direction of the proof where to go. Here. This direction. If we're self-adjoint and we can actually see the self-adjointness with respect to the standard basis, so we can see it. Ah, yes. It's equal to its transpose, which in the reals is the conjugate transpose, too. Then, yes, we can diagonalize. And I might even give them the other form of it. You know, you talk about the change of basis formula. You know, it's you have matrix A, and then you have some invertible matrix, I don't call it P or whatever, and then you have P inverse AP becomes diagonal or something like that. But as you can see with this course, we're not emphasizing all those matrix formulas. We only really use the matrices in this course to make it easier for us to prove stuff. Because it's really all about the structure. What kinds of linear operators are there? And the matrix helps us, but it's not so much that we're excited about the matrix being diagonal as we're excited about having a basis of eigenvectors. The eigenvectors are very simply transformed by the operator.
Different emphases between a first
linear algebra course and a second linear algebra course. Now, let's see here. I'm thinking for your homework, that's numbers 8 and 9. Some interesting, but hopefully not too difficult problems. Okay. And it's not quite 7:15, but it's close, so I shouldn't try to launch into another example or exercise. Any questions or comments? I don't have any homework to hand back right now, but if you want to add to my grading pile, I will, of course, accept that.